This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1.
Hi, this is Bob Fetrakis. I'm here with Michael Allwood, the managing editor of the new weekly Free Press. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Bob. It's always a pleasure to be talking to you.
Last time you were here, there was not yet an issue. Now you've put out two issues of the weekly Free Press. Let's discuss them a little. Issue one, Scandal, Corruption, and Cover-Ups Plague Columbus City School. That among many other articles. What would you say about the first issue?
Well, I can say, and I suppose that you're going to have to tell the story, but from what I understand, the lead story about corruption and scandal in Columbus schools had an immediate impact. And I know you're on the, what's it called?
The Near East Area Commission.
Yeah, and something special happened Thursday night, I believe, the day our second edition came out. You had a special visitor to the commission. Who was that?
Well, the interim superintendent, Dan Good, was there and made numerous references to the article, which, of course, he said that he doesn't disagree with it. I think it's a very fact-heavy article. As someone who edited it, you know that. So he didn't really refute the facts of the article, but insisted that it's a new day and some people have been punished or resigned. I think the number he used, 13 in all, have either resigned or are facing some sort of punishment.
I'm curious whether or not he went through the list of the people who were allowed to retire without any repercussions.
Well, I think he may have thrown those in, and sort of his argument, if they had to retire prematurely, it is a form of punishment. By the way, he pointed out that he wanted to retire and thought he was going to do so this year. But the fact you'd have the interim superintendent out addressing the article specifically.
Well, it means we got somebody's attention. And probably more than one somebody. And I want to ask you whether or not he specifically addressed the retirement of former Superintendent Jean Harris and how she seems to have gotten free of Columbus City Schools, smelling like a rose, you might say.
Ah, smelling like a rose. Rosa Smith, who also left town in the middle of corruption, smelling exactly like a rose.
Yeah.
But no, but some of the area commissioners brought that up, and so did certain people from the community, including Willis Brown, who talked about people needing to go to jail. And there was some of that sentiment from some of the commissioners as well. You can say that, you know, this is all factually true. You can say that, you know, it's behind us, but where's the accountability? Was there criminal activity? And I think what concerns a lot of people, Michael, is if me or you on our jobs, if we were state employees and we essentially falsified public records, we would probably do some jail time.
Probably, yes.
And so it strikes a lot of people that that this is really being swept under the rug when no one's really talking about at least, you know, misdemeanor, first degree, falsification of public records.
And let me take this opportunity to tell listeners and our readers that this is not a one-shot deal. We are going to keep our eyes on what is happening with Columbus City Schools, and we're going to keep an eye on what's happening with the campaigning for the levy. It's, in our view, the levy is ill-timed, and the way they are presenting it to the public is iffy. And you mentioned Dan Good coming to the area commission and saying, you know, we're in a new day. We're at, to me, it's like you know, a rusty tin building, and you apply a fresh coat of paint on it and say, hey, you know, everything's okay now. It's look at it. It's red now. It's not rust red. It's red. It's crimson red. And it's the same thing is going on. And essentially, they're trying to sell. The mayor has led the fight on the levy, trying to sell it to the people by saying, and in some of the advertisements that are pro levy, they're basically saying, look, our children are going to school in a system that was not able to educate them properly, and all you need to do is give us some more money and everything's going to be hunky-dory. And you know, again, going back to the article in the initial Free Press, we've shown in there that the money sometimes gets farmed out to people who don't deserve it and shouldn't have been recipient of those federal funds. And what's to tell the public that any new money they get as a result of the levy isn't going to be as carelessly spent as it has been in the past? That's what I want to know.
And it would be a good thing to know. Is it a systemic problem? Have you solved those problems within the system? Or does it just mean the new money is going to be abused and misused in the same way that the old funds were? A variety of other things in the first issue, Michael, as well. Jerry Bello and I wrote an article on NSA spying, national issues. A interesting article by Jonathan Beard. A developer submits purchase offer for Poindexter Village. Is this part of the local muckraking or just giving other perspectives? The mainstream corporate media would have us believe that there's no value to Poindexter Village.
When everybody in the neighborhood and everybody associated with any of or has any knowledge of the history of Poindexter Village will tell you that it has value in it as much a way as, say, what if somebody come in and said, you know, the Levesque Tower has outlived its usefulness and needs to be torn down in favor of a new edifice? Do you think there might be some people up in arms about it?
Yeah, particularly the people that work there, and that's part of the downtown community.
And within the African-American community on the east side, they view Poindexter Village as being a landmark historic structure or series of structures. But nobody's listening, though. If you read Jonathan's article, time and again, the powers that be brush off their concerns as if you know, it's a done deal and everything they're doing is right and your proposals don't make any sense. And so that, you know, that's a sense of frustration within the community over the way this has gone down, and that story is not yet complete.
Now, if somebody wants to write to the Free Press, has a perspective, has read these articles, whether it's downtown Columbus janitors announced strike, or the question of Poindexter Village, or the school board, how can they submit a letter to the editor?
It's very easy. All they have to do is email letters@columbusfreepress.com. letters@columbusfreepress.com. We welcome any letters, even of praise or criticism. Either way, we are more than happy to take your letters, and you'll see them, most likely see them in print until such time as we just don't have enough room for all the letters we do get. But I do encourage people to email their concerns, their criticism, ideas about what they'd like to see. I'm not closing my mind to suggestions from the general public. So anything they want to write about, especially if there's a concern that maybe we're not aware of, an issue that needs addressed. A lot of stories in a lot of newspapers have their genesis in letters to the editor that bring about issues that the editors were not aware of. This happens frequently. I'm sure you've had it happen to you in the past. People bring you little tidbits, and they turn out to be good stories. So once again, letters@columbusfreepress.com, and we welcome them.
All right. In the first issue, as well as the second, you've covered the question of decriminalization of marijuana, as well as the medical use of marijuana. Why?
Well, I think it's a very important issue. I mean, if you look, in fact, if you looked at those stories, there are an incredible percentage of prisoners in our prisons in the United States are there for marijuana violations. And here you have a plant that comes right from Mother Earth, and it has been criminalized. And because of its association with marijuana, hemp has also been criminalized. Our founding fathers, some of them raised hemp. It has many uses. And Michael Rivercom, in a piece that he wrote for us, makes the case that the reason marijuana and hemp haven't been legalized is because big oil and big pharma, those are the people who keep it criminalized, because hemp can provide a clean fuel. Hemp can provide medical usages, pharmaceutical usages that would take away from the profits of big pharma, take away from the profits of big oil. He argues that that's the main reason. But there's also the matter of, and this kind of interlaces with the issue of privatizing of the prisons. The prisons are making money off of criminals, and those people don't want to see marijuana being decriminalized because it would cut back on their business. So that's the reason probably that we, you know, the percentage of the American public who think that marijuana should be decriminalized is quite large. They are in the majority in thinking that marijuana should be decriminalized. And so it's, once again, those old powers that be that keep it criminalized. And that's why we're going to cover it, because it can do a lot of people a lot of good. It can create jobs. It can create tax revenue. And so why not do it? Well, because it has opponents that are powerful, and that's why.
And you've got a little more in the paper besides those politically controversial issues. It appears the Free Press has a certified sex specialist.
That's right, the Lady Monster. And she is, in fact, a certified sex I'm not sure a therapist is the right word.
She has a S on, capital S, specialist.
Oh, specialist, yes.
So I'm not sure how you get certified as a specialist.
She actually worked at the on a hotline in San Francisco and went through extensive training to do that. So it's not somebody just scribbling in their parlor over. She knows what she's talking about. And you know, all you have to do if you want to take part in the Lady Monsters column is she has a special way that you can do it anonymously. And the way to do that is probably go to our website, because I don't know what the link is off the top of my
LadyMonsterLair@gmail.com.
And she has a way.
LadyMonsterLair.
And I want to assure
@gmail.com.
assure people that she has a filtering device on there, and anything that gets dropped into that box, the sender's identity is removed from it. So it is completely, you can feel rest assured that your identity is not open to the public, or even to the Lady Monster. She won't know who you are, and she will answer your questions without need of knowing who you are.
And I know this from personal experience. I mean, I know it's a good design, Michael.
Okay.
Your
Since
paper,
Suzanne's sitting in the room, I think that was probably a good change of wording.
The search for the great Columbus pierogi, was it found?
It was. And in fact, now that you mention that, I will say that one of the bumps in the road that we've encountered was because of technical issues that I will not get into in the second edition of the Free Press that was out just Thursday, we told Columbus again about finding the pierogi, and when it was indeed supposed to be an article about an historic Columbus pizza palace, Leonardo's. And we will have that for the people in issue number 3, which comes out this Thursday, and we will correct those mistakes, and we hope not to see any of them in future.
This is WCRS 98.3 and 102.1 Community Radio. Let's see. There's no conspiracy at work here, sort of like a small group of Polish investors that are pushing the pierogi issue.
No. Let's just chalk it up to computers.
Okay.
And leave it at that.
And sports coverage, it looks like soccer is a reoccurring theme in these first two issues, Michael.
And that won't always be the case. We'll have a variety of things to talk about, but it just so happens that a very big event happened, and that was the World Cup qualifier between the United States and Mexico. And that is an internationally important event, particularly in North America. And it's a heated rivalry. In fact, it's got a nickname, Dos a Cero, which means 2-0. And once again, the United States did, in fact, win that match last week, 2-0. So Patrick Dolgan actually mentioned how the rivalry had got its nickname, and sure enough, the final score was just that, 2-0.
All right. And again, the geek pages seem to be filled up. Marvel Comics.
Yeah, we're very pleased to have a number of people who are quite clever and really know their material. We think that there's a real place. I know that I've had a number of people comment about being happy to see those items in our pages. I just want to thank the people at Laughing Ogre for pointing us in the direction of our staff of geek writers, who are very happy to have that vehicle to share their interest with the public.
And again, one of my favorite pieces in the first issue, Michael, John Petrick, who issued a apology. Is he sincere? Will he be changing his ways and become a kinder, gentler critic?
Well, I have to be perfectly honest with you, Bob. I suspect that John's tongue is firmly in cheek with that little atonement piece that he wrote for us. He was very pleased seeing Fred Wesley at the Hot Times Festival laying down the funk along with a bunch of local musicians, which is what his second piece for the Free Press was in the issue that just came out on Thursday. He was delighted by Fred Wesley, and it was obvious in his piece again from this past Thursday. However, just fair warning, tonight John is going to see Queens of the Stone Age at Lifetime Pavilion, I believe is where it is. Promo West Production. John's going to that. And I have no way of predicting this, but somehow I think that maybe this Thursday we might see the old Petrick back in form. And I don't think that's a bad thing. If there's one thing that I've had remarks about from people off the street about, it has been Petrick. People have described him as the critic people love to hate. And then there's other people who are delighted by his writing. You can count me among those people. Whether I agree or disagree with John's opinion about music, it doesn't matter. He's still... His voice is very amusing to me. He's a wordsmith of the highest order, and I enjoy reading him no matter what he's talking about.
And again, with Red Meat, one of my favorite comics, Dan the Milkman, in the first issue.
Yeah.
Dealing with the issue of dolphins. I forgot to turn my phone off. Maybe that's Patrick or Dan the Milkman. Let's see what we got
is it Patrick?
It was Dan the Milkman urging people to read his comic.
By the way,
and this crossword puzzle.
I'm sorry.
You said by the way.
Oh yeah, I would like to hear from some local artists. If there are local artists who are able to provide a comic strip, I would be very pleased.
I've run into a few who do great illustrations. Now, I don't know whether if they do comics, but we're encouraging people. Because we'll take kind of dark Marvel-type comics as well.
Absolutely. And you were saying about the crossword.
I thought the crossword puzzle was a bit hard.
Did you?
I mean, it's challenging. It's sort of, you know, I thought I was just going to whip through it.
I think that we should have a challenging crossword. It's a weekly crossword. And so...
So you're thinking some people like myself, it may take them a week. I see you out there on the patio at the Free Press abode whipping through this.
I'm a veteran crossword solver.
And you use pen only.
Yeah.
I'm going to use a real sharp number two pencil.
All right. A pencil on newsprint gives me the willies, so... it's just one of those tactile things that, like fingers on a chalkboard, it bothers me. So I use pen.
All right. Issue 2 came out Thursday. We're doing this interview on Sunday, so we're right in the middle here. The cover story, which I wrote, Welcome to the Machine, wrote with Jonathan Beard, who would have improved it immensely, but again,
John was in the
hospital. Was in the hospital. It would have been a much better article had John been there, but for the final. But he'll
no
be
fault
back.
Of his own. Through yeah. no fault of his own.
So welcome to the machine, and really, Michael, we're talking about the Columbus political machine and how it fits in.
Surprisingly, you know, the thing that I think might shock a few people when they read it is the fact that this is a Democratic Party-controlled machine, and we, you know, those of us lefties kind of want to believe that our Democrats are good people and are want to do the right thing, but we find in Columbus not a unique set of circumstance, but simply an unusual set of circumstance. In that that machine has managed to keep control of city council by having people resign and then appointing people to take those seats, and then that allows those new council people to run in the next election as an incumbent, which gives them not only a great deal of advantage in terms of name recognition, but it also gives them access to political funds to run those campaigns, and in most cases, if not all cases, are able to outspend their opponents no matter what stripe they come from. And that's the way. That's in a nutshell. I mean, you wrote the article. Have I gone astray here?
No. I mean, by having it at large, you need the quarter of $1 million, and very few people can raise that, other than the mayor and maybe the city council president, so it makes all the other elected officials. And one of the things we turned up in researching the article, Michael, and I know you're aware of this, is we in 1816, when the borough, not the city, the borough of Columbus with 700 people was founded, we had 9 city councilmen.
And they were
how were they elected?
By wards.
By ward.
So you were so those councilmen were representing a particular section of the borough, in most cases, right where they lived. And so they represented the people who lived around them, and the next ward over, the same thing. Councilman represented the people who lived near him, and I say him because in most cases back in, what did you say the date was,
1816,
I can almost guarantee you that each and every one of those city councilmen were men.
They were men.
Yes.
And
at one time, Columbus had 22 city council people, and so we've pared it down to 7 now. So that and in the meantime,
22 at large,
not they're wards.
Wards,
yeah. And now we have 7 at large. So what that is accomplished in the interim time is we've shrunk the members of city council while our population has exploded from that since that time.
So how do you get personal attention to your neighborhood when you've got a city of 800,000 people, 7 at large council people, when back in 1816 we had 9, 2 more, and they were all by ward?
Well, it's,
and the city was a lot smaller, Michael. We've got one of the largest cities in America, 225 square miles.
Right. Well, it's because, again, as the population has grown and the members have shrunk, it's gotten increasingly difficult to present any issues to the council. And making matters even worse, Columbus City Council has cut back on the methods by which the citizens are able to address the city council. They are denying people the right to speak and bring up new topics by putting in new rules, while nothing, I think it's currently nothing that's not on the agenda for that evening can be addressed by the general public. Am I right about that?
Well, they'll allow a certain part at the end, but they'll limit the amount of speakers to just 3. And here's the thing they've stopped doing, Michael. They no longer televise the non-agenda remarks. So you can go there,
which is where,
and you can speak if you're lucky. Not everyone who wants to speak can speak, and they turn off the cameras.
So what you're saying is the really important decisions and activities go on behind closed doors, not open to the public?
That's what it appears to be, that they decide ahead of time what the agenda item is, what the action item is, and then they vote on it. When it appears on the agenda, you know it's already decided, and nothing else will appear on the agenda and really can be discussed. And if you're lucky enough to raise an issue, it's not going to be televised to the city to get a citywide debate. And again, when we had the 22 city councilmen in 1911, all by ward, the city was less than 25 square miles. So it's grown nearly tenfold, and we now have 7 instead of 22.
And I'm sure the population growth has been similar.
Yeah, there was about 181,000 people then, as opposed
to... So at this point in time, the 7 at large council people are representing more Columbusites today than at any time in our history.
Absolutely, and not only that, we are the only city, major city, of the top 5 cities to have only at-large council people. Every other city has wards or a combination of wards and at-large.
I see that we only have a minute or so left, so let me give you a few things that are coming up this Thursday in the third edition. Of course, we will have something from Harvey Wasserman. We appreciate being associated with Harvey. He's an environmentalist par excellence. I mentioned that John will be reviewing the Queens of the Stone Age concert that's happening Sunday night. And we're, the lead story is one coming from you, Bob. What happened to Occupy? What can we expect?
Well, we're going to look at what killed Occupy and let readers decide. And we're going to go back and talk to the people who names and faces became synonymous with Occupy Columbus. That's it. We got to wrap up. Michael Allwood, thanks for being on The Other Side of the News.
Always a pleasure.